Hi, everybody. My name is Nell Taylor. I'm the founder and executive director of the Read Write Library. We are a pilot program that is based in Chicago. But what I'm hoping to lay out here today is perhaps a foundation that we can all use to think about scaling this project, or at least scaling some of the ideas behind it. So I'm going to be talking about the project, but I also hope that there are some bigger takeaways that we can all think about in terms of not just designing library collections, but designing civic tools, designing technology tools, and designing data. So a big theme at South by Southwest this year, and that's been going through the technology community in the last few years, has been civic technology. I myself am bouncing back and forth a lot this weekend between the library panels, the civic tech panels, the open government panels. And all this stuff is really amazing and really super fascinating to me. There's a ton going on in the community media world right now, the Night News Challenge that you've probably been hearing about all weekend via Twitter. They're doing amazing work with trying to get media up from the bottom up through different communities. And all this is great. So what my concern is primarily that all the tools that we're working on focus on getting news out there now. And that when we think about building things and building these tools and building infrastructure for our cities and infrastructure for news and information, that we're not really building on much of anything. We have a lot of structures out there and a lot of things in place and a lot of traditional models that we can use to view this stuff and organize it, but we have a giant gap in our cultural memory. We haven't really come up with a way so far that we can take the kinds of material that everybody is so excited about now, but it was the kind of material that people have already been producing for years, for decades, for hundreds of years. And there's not currently any sort of infrastructure to get this into the flow of information so that we can actually build tools that take into account the needs of these communities. So when you go into a hackathon now to go and build a civic technology tool, sometimes you can rapid prototype this stuff in as much or as little as 4 hours. And it's phenomenal what you can do to get things out, to go to a neighborhood and say, hey, look, we've provided this for you. Here are the tools to use it. But if you don't actually understand where that neighborhood or that community is coming from, or you're only looking at data from that neighborhood that you can find online that goes back, you know, maybe 10, 15 years at most, how are you fully going to grasp what the historical needs are, what the tensions are in a community, and where they're coming from that they got to where they are today? So we also need to be able to recognize not only the fact that these tensions and these needs exist, but that the people who live in all these communities actually have meaningful contributions to make. If you work in the cultural sector, you're probably very familiar with the myth of the solo artist, where, you know, some genius person creates alone in their basement and it comes fully formed out of their mind. Now, of course, we know that people and ideas and great thinkers do not exist in a vacuum. There are lots of factors that go and contribute to how those ideas get formed. So this image that you see right here is actually a direct image of infrastructure taken from my neighborhood on the west side of Chicago. I was walking down the street one day and saw a manhole cover that was totally empty and open, and someone had had the brilliant idea to go and plug that with a road cone. So what we see here is actually the physical manifestation of plugging a hole with another hole. And my contention as we move forward in this presentation and talk about what we're building on and where we're thinking that we can fill these holes and these gaps in our cultural memory, the internet is not going to accomplish that for us unless we feed the internet a lot more information. All we're doing, if we expect that this information that we've already been ignoring culturally, historically, if we expect that the internet is just going to go and find all that for us magically and bring it in, then all we're doing is just plugging a hole. We're plugging our blind spots with another blind spot, unless someone is actively going out there and putting this cultural information from all of these diverse communities into this flow of information, then no one is going to do it. I'm sure with a lot of, do we have a lot of librarians in the room, I would imagine? Oh, great. Actually, that's less than I expected, and I'm really happy about that. Do we have civic technology folks in the room? Anybody? How about marketing folks? All right, awesome. I'm going to talk about search engine optimization in a little bit, so rock on. So you're probably familiar, especially if you're a librarian, with the idea that everything is online, right? It's the idea that's killing your jobs right now. So if we think about the fact that everything is online and we subscribe to that myth, all we're actually doing is reinforcing our blind spots and our own biases and saying we don't need to do any further work to make sure we're being diverse and inclusive. So what this actually leads to is erasure by omission. And these are pretty strong words, but I mean every single word of this. This is hugely important because this is an urgent issue. Constant pieces of really valuable data are being discarded every day. And you find this valuable data in things like community newspapers. You find it in poetry chapbooks written by 13-year-olds about their neighborhoods. You find it in artist books where they're trying to come to terms with the changes that are happening around them, and the media that they've chosen to express this through happens to be a hand-bound book. There's all sorts of incredible first-person primary source data out there. And I'll tell you, a lot of our collection has come from me just wandering around and finding someone getting rid of boxes of this stuff in an alley somewhere. So this is something that is constantly being discarded. And, you know, there's a reason for that. We have a long history of just ignoring this. How many of you are familiar with the term vanity press from publishing? The idea that anything that anybody puts out there that doesn't have an official large mainstream publisher is not something that's worth looking at. So if we don't get this data out there and make it visible somehow, we're not going to be able to change the culture in a way that fully accepts and understands this material. So I'd like to propose an impossibility to all of you. The idea that it is possible to archive everything. A couple of months ago, I was at a conference, and there was a really fantastic plenary session, and there was an archivist there who talked with disdain about the kind of things that make up our collection in the Read-Write Library. And his whole argument was, we as archivists don't have a responsibility to and can't possibly archive everything. We have to enforce gatekeepers specifically because we just can't handle it. And this was actually his argument for saying these are the reasons why we need to keep people out, because we as archivists and librarians haven't figured out the system yet. He didn't say it in those words. That was my interpretation of it. I wish he would have, because that's really just what he was saying. So I feel like if we go and we start to say that our own limitations are what determines whose ideas live and thrive and whose don't, that we're setting up something that's hugely problematic. So what I'm going to propose is a little bit of imagination, a little bit of theory, and how my organization in Chicago, which has pretty much zero funding and a large core of volunteers, but a lot of really interesting people and a lot of legwork, is actually making this happen. So what do we actually do? Our collection is Chicago-specific. It incorporates every single thing, all the way from university press down to those zines that I mentioned made by 13-year-olds. We believe that collections that are exclusively about the micromedia or about the small publications are actually just as problematic in a lot of ways as the ones that are large. What happens when you go and you take the small media and set it to the side? It means that you're not connecting it to the larger conversation. You're essentially saying it's okay that this stays outside. And there are a lot of good arguments for that. You know, some communities were producing their media specifically because they needed to have an environment that was closed where they could have these conversations among themselves. And that's great. But there are also a lot of people who wanted their media to get into the flow of public conversation. So that's where we come in. We say that published is defined broadly as anything that's intended for public consumption. So, So when you actually say that it's anything intended for public consumption, you can go and you can create this really broad way of pulling all of this media in. and just making it visible, getting these voices heard, I want to just talk really quickly about an important distinction between making media visible and the idea of giving people a voice. If any of you work in social justice or community activist communities, you've probably heard people say that they give people agency, they give people a voice. That might be some of the reason why they get involved in this. One really easy way to annoy people who work in those communities, too, is to say, hey, listen, we're here, we're outsiders, and now we're going to give you that voice. Well, the thing is, people already have a voice. All of these different communities have voices. They've been putting this material out there forever. And it's our responsibility as the people who've determined that we are the keepers of the historical record to listen to that and to make sure that we're really doing it justice. So in order to do that justice, what we really need to do is come up with an entirely new way of framing how culture engages with this media. When you think about that archivist who I mentioned at this conference earlier who said, well, we need to have gatekeepers because we can't deal with this stuff, you know, there are all kinds of different biases that figure into this. So what we're trying to do is figure out not only how to collect this stuff and to catalog it, but also to treat it in a way that helps change the cultural mindset of whether this stuff is valuable in the first place. I've gone and done set up pop-up libraries at street fairs where someone will come up to me and laugh in my face and tell me that they wouldn't pay a dollar for anything that's on our table. And I'm like, great, I'm not asking you to. You are obviously not the intended audience. But the idea is that we can't just say, all right, so you're not the intended audience and walk away from these people. We need to figure out how we can actually build tools for relevance and understanding and cultural change into these types of systems. So in order to think about an active citizenry, a citizenry that engages in its city, that participates, you actually need to be treating the people who you interact with and who you're asking to come to the table and give you knowledge like they can make actual contributions. I went to a panel earlier on do people actually want participatory government or not? And there was a lot of conversation that said, well, you know, we ask people for feedback and then they don't give it. So what we're interested in is how can we bring those people to the table and tell them we really want to hear from you. That involves treating their media that they've already put out there with a certain level of respect. So what we do is we presume that every object in our collection is actually of equal value. Now, this can be really hard for a lot of the gatekeepers to wrap their heads around because their natural inclination is to go and, you know, say, well, this is good or bad because of this or that. And we're not against critical thinking at all. We love critical thinking. What we want people to do is think about how that context can actually make you think critically better. If you take everything, whether it's written by somebody who has, you know, an eighth grade level education or somebody who's a tenured professor at the University of Chicago, once you start to put these things side by side and give them equal value and see the way that they connect to one another, the context becomes extremely important. So it might seem that a major step in building this infrastructure doesn't rely on technology at all if it's cultural, right? It's going out and meeting people. To take another model from community organizing, meeting people where they're at, showing this stuff to people. But actually, a huge amount of what we do relies on theories of participatory culture. So when we collect this media, we're not going and saying that ultimately one of these things has to rise to the top. We're not interested in you thumbing up or thumbing down something in our collection. We believe and we trust people that they can sort that stuff out on their own if we give them enough information about it. Now, the information is where it gets tricky, because it would be really, really super wonderful if all this data was very nice and clean, and if the city behaved in such a way where when the city changed, you would actually just see that the way that this image shows you. You know, clearly at one point, this one community was here, another community came in, built something side by side. That's great. You know, communities do evolve. Communities do change. We want to acknowledge change. So, unfortunately, data doesn't look like that. Data in a city, when cities change and evolve, looks more like this. So, it's a mess, but it's fascinating. The longer you look at it, the longer it really starts to make you think about, well, okay, so what was going on in this building? What was going on in this community that it somehow managed to change from maybe a manufacturing or industrial area into an area that was centered on food? Is this a distribution warehouse? What are the interests and needs of the people who might have been here in this space at this time? So obviously, organizing all this information has all kinds of challenges that traditional libraries are not at all used to dealing with. A big part of the reason is that the people who produce this media don't think about libraries or traditional publishing at all. They're not going out and saying, you know, I expect that this is going to wind up in a bookstore in a library, so I'm going to make sure that it says very clearly on the back that this fits in under literature, poetry, and, you know, the people who produce this media don't care about hierarchies. They're not thinking about hierarchies or marketing. So what we needed to do was figure out a way that we as librarians can take into account the way that the producers themselves in all of these diverse communities think about their own identities and their own media that they're producing. So what we do is we actually go and we catalog by every single contributor. This is, again, thinking about breaking down those hierarchies and saying, okay, so who are the artists who contributed to this? Who are the editors? Who are the typesetters? Who are the graphic designers? Who's the editorial board? Who are the people who took the photos for this? Because when you're actually going and looking at this from a community level, all this media becomes all this information becomes very, very, very rich. So what happens when you go and you put all these names side by side and you actually have your catalogers get together every single Tuesday night in a group like they've been doing for 4 years. Even when we got hit by a blizzard back in February and lost our space for 6 months, our cataloging manager still put books on his bike and drove to a coffee shop every single week to keep this going. We keyword by every single person who contributed, every proper name, every neighborhood, and marketers in the house. What that does is it actually makes our data work extremely, extremely well with search engines. And the idea behind this is you can actually use search engine optimization and a keyword-based cataloging system to make media that was previously marginalized compete alongside the historical record. So one of the reasons why it's very important that we do this is because all of these communities, especially within a city like Chicago that's very fragmented along racial and socioeconomic lines, there are a lot of people who have a lot of shared interests and a lot of shared needs that have no idea that a neighborhood, however many miles south of them, is thinking about the same thing. This actually puts up huge barriers not only to empathy and cultural understanding, but also to community organizing and to political activity and to civic change. So think about if you had a cultural layer in your civic technology where you could actually build programs on top of that and organize as different communities to say, hey, listen, you are thinking about this same thing, we're thinking about this. If we bring our needs together, we can actually more effectively organize and mobilize. So this is not just a matter of neighborhood fragmentation either. When I first started this project 5-6 years ago, I talked to a lot of people who'd say, hey, I'm an artist and I want to know somewhere to go to collaborate with a poet, but I don't know any poets. Or I'm a fiction writer and I've never talked to anybody who writes nonfiction. And that seems ridiculous at first. We talk about creative communities like they're this great, wonderful thing and everybody finds each other, and that's not true at all. So what would happen if you actually decided that the city was your library and your citizens were your librarians? One of the ways that libraries work really well for this kind of structure is librarians are really able to approach problems like this with neutrality. So it starts to break down the issue of whether everything can be equal or not. There's a huge amount of humility that needs to go into a project like this, because when we're going to these different communities and saying, we want to take your media out of context, we want to take your media out of the place that you've built for it, that's safe and warm, where you know people will agree with you, that can be really scary. especially if you're a community that's been burned before by people telling you over and over again, I'm going to do right by you and I'm going to do right by your identity and what's important to you. So we need to be very careful when we take this media in and make sure that we're going to these communities open-handed and saying, we'll do the best we can. We'll go and we'll keyword this to the best of our ability, but then we'll put it online and actually ask you to tell us what's wrong. So we treat every single one of the publications in our collection as a social object. The phrase that we throw around that, as far as I know, we completely made up is controlled crowdsourcing. So it's not like Wikipedia where you can go and just edit anything at will. It's more storytelling. Each one of these objects has a comment area on it where you can go and talk about it. You can go and say, hey, you switched up what the title is with what the subtitle is. Can you go and change it? Or you can say, hey, it looks like you don't have a lot of information on that. I actually know the people who produced that, and you can start a whole conversation going in the comments about this stuff. So subjective data and editable data is really messy, but when you're thinking about trying to get community rights, it's something that you have to be able to deal with, or else you're not really going to be able to take into account what the community needs and what they're thinking. So the way that localized libraries work incredibly well for something like this is you have these built-in networks already. What we're doing with this project is we're building parallel networks. We're building networks on the ground and we're building networks online so that we can go and make sure that people who have an ability to go and change and edit this data and give us the right kind of information about it to ensure that it's correct and culturally sensitive are seeing it. So a publication's community might not exist any longer. We have in our collection something called CHAOS. It's from the Chicago Area Origami Society. It's one of my favorite acronyms in the world. And so when we see something like this, it was just sent to me via email, and this guy said, hey, I've got 20 years of this publication that I used to make from, I want to say, like early 80s to early 2000s. And this world, this universe of these networked origami artists in Chicago doesn't exist anymore. It started out as a newsletter community, and I realized once I got the publications from him that a large portion of it was missing in the middle. That set off this huge chain of emails from people who he hadn't talked with in 10 years about where these publications might be, who took over for this. So when you can actually work through these networks and get people thinking about what they might have missed, who they haven't connected with, you can actually go and get all the data that you need just by talking to the right people and telling them, hey, we're open to it and we're not trying to make presumptions that we know everything about your community. So the networks on the ground looks something like this. To take another example from community organizing, there's this principle of letting people be self-defining. Self-determination is huge. So what we ask people to think about is, can we privilege connections between all these publications over our definitions of quality? Can we privilege this over our ideas of what regional means? We ask people to think that community is self-defining. So if you think that your work belongs in a collection about Chicago, hey, then it probably does. So that could mean that, you know, maybe it's from a suburb just west of Chicago. Maybe it's from Joliet. Maybe it's from further downstate. But what's more interesting to us than saying, all right, if it's not within 2-mile radius of the city limits, then it doesn't count, is actually saying, well, how useful is the data to us in terms of how it provides more context for understanding this media? If the data is useful, that means we can end up taking things from as far afield as the Calumet region of northwestern Indiana and still having it provide more valuable data to us about communities in our city. So here's just one example of what a community might look like when it's within a city. These are publications from the bike community in Chicago that started out very small and very radical long, long time ago and is now huge and legitimate and actually is able to shut down the entire main thoroughfare in Chicago, Lakeshore Drive, every year to have tons and tons of bicyclists drive through it. So when you think about how interesting would it be for you to be able to track how that community developed, how it organized, how it got from point A, when it was just this little nascent thing of bike messengers just being able to even think about organizing and fighting for their rights to have health insurance and to be self-determining, to actually see now how big this has gotten and made Chicago an incredibly bike-friendly city. So one of the things that you can do when you have this type of media is give people different ways to enter into the conversation. Maybe you're really interested in bikes. So you're like, hey, I didn't think about the fact that I could go and produce media. I'm interested in bikes. Look at that. Someone's making media about bikes. Now, one way to also look at giving people a foothold into the conversation is locality. What all these are publications by the poet Gwendolyn Brooks. And Gwendolyn Brooks was the first African-American winner of the Pulitzer Prize. She was the poet laureate of Illinois. And if you grow up in Chicago or the suburbs, you learn so much about her, and she seems larger than life to you. But if you know that she's from the south side of Chicago, and maybe she lived just six blocks away from you, maybe all of a sudden it seems a little bit more tangible. It seems like something that, hey, you know, she's coming from where I'm coming from. She's coming from a place that starts with a similar cultural background, that starts with a similar orientation as far as what resources are available. Maybe I can actually be Gwendolyn Brooks after all, and it doesn't have to seem so far away. So how do these networks play out online? Well, one thing that we can do is think about how you can use the media that's online to go and reach out to people and actually show you how all these different people influence each other. Because we're reaching very wide, we can actually place people who are typically not in the regular conversation in media at all, such as these publications by various people who are incarcerated. What we have here is two publications that come from two different juvenile detention centers in Chicago, and one publication that's made by women who are in prison. And you can actually go and see, you know, who are the mentors in these publications? Who are the people who are teaching these writing workshops? Another really interesting way to think about the people teaching these workshops is to go and look at youth media or literacy media. So this is a collection that we have that's just kind of a small representation of some of the literacy materials. If you were in the session earlier today about storytelling and community media with libraries, Nate Hill brought up a great point that content creation is not just for youth. Content creation is something that's for people of all ages. So there are phenomenal adult literacy programs in Chicago. Now, a couple things you can't see because these photos are dark and blurry is that one of those publications in the middle actually has a foreword by someone named Joe Mino. And two of those publications actually have covers by an internationally renowned artist named Tony Fitzpatrick. Both Joe Mino and Tony Fitzpatrick live in the city of Chicago. Both of them have been contributing to publications in the city for 10, 20, sometimes 30 years in the case of Tony Fitzpatrick. Now, how interesting is it to be able to track where each of them got their start, looking at Joe Mino, where he was a contributor to Bail, which was a short-lived publication run by Dan Sinker, who is also speaking this weekend at South by Southwest. And you can actually follow these people and how they influenced each other and how they connected to one another and how they, as mentors and writing workshop teachers in the youth media or adult literacy sector or in the prison writing sector, are actually going and influencing people to create their own media. When we catalog by interns and the typesetters and everyone, we're also really getting this incredible amount of valuable data. You take someone from Young Chicago Authors, and you can see where they went on to work at their local school newspaper, or they went on to be an editor or publisher in their own right. So one fun thing that you can do with the online networks is actually go fishing with data. This is where the search engine stuff starts to get really interesting, because with the kinds of things that we do with this data, how many of you Google yourselves online? Be honest. So people love to do that. And what happens is they find themselves in our collection. So this is an example right here of how someone who was a contributor to the After Hours publication just was sitting around in his apartment in New York one day Googling himself and happened to see, hey, you have my poem in this collection. He then wrote me an email and said, I used to live in Chicago. Did you know that I also produced this magazine in the 80s called Tomorrow Magazine? By the way, I've also since then written three novels about what it was like to live in the city at that time. And the next time he was in Chicago, he brought me a giant box that he paid that $30 travel fee to bring on the plane. And it was the entire record of everything that he and his community had produced in Chicago, even though he didn't even live here anymore. So this media, besides the preservation aspect and besides making it visible and helping people kind of see it, is also to help them make use of it. So this can be in a lot of ways. It can be through direct interpretation. But what we're really interested in is, can you kind of use this participatory culture framework to go through the full spectrum and get people out on the other end as content producers? So it's not enough for us just to say that it's out there. We want people to really think about using this to show them a pathway. This is a group of media here that I pulled for a student who came in one day. He was trying to go to something called Broadway Youth Center, which is a drop-in center for lesbian gay youth in Chicago. And they happened to be closed that day, so he was wandering around, wandered into the library, and he was there with a friend of his who was on her headphones and making fun of him for wanting to go to college. And he had his sketchbook with him, and we were talking about, hey, where do you want to go to school? And he said, well, I want to go to Columbia College. And I said, well, let's get your sketchbook out and see what you have. And I have this publication here from the art department at Columbia College. Let's put those two things side by side and see how it compares. And hey, lo and behold, it compared great. So I looked at his sketchbook and went to the shelf and found a publication of really wonderful, super cool local graffiti artists drawing over photos. And he looked through that for a while, and then I pulled up a Kerry James Marshall book from the Hyde Park Arts Center near where he lived that had all these great paintings of Martin Luther King, and Kerry James Marshall is a wonderful, socially engaged artist. If you don't know him, look him up. And so he pored over that for a while and said, oh, hey, Martin Luther King Day is tomorrow. That's probably why Broadway Youth Center is closed today. And then at this point, he was interested enough in the collection that he went to the shelves by himself and just started pulling things off left and right. Over there in the corner, that book, As It Is, was a book of material by an artist named Tony Tassett, who's a really super inaccessible, very difficult to penetrate conceptual artist. And he started opening up this book and looking through it and couldn't believe that this was actually art, that people went and made installation art and actually sold this in galleries. And so within 20 minutes, we'd gotten him from his sketchbook to completely blowing his mind open about not only the fact that he could compete alongside other artists at the school that he was interested in going to, but completely changing his notion of what was possible as far as an artist. So when we think about our physical space and what we can do with it, we can't just count on people to wander in off the street. We have to make sure that we're really going out into the neighborhoods. So we do these things called pop-up libraries. And what pop-up libraries have been great for is for us to be able to go to a neighborhood organization and say, tell us what your mission is, tell us who you're trying to serve, tell us what the needs and interests of your community are at this point. And we'll do the best that we can to bring a selection out with us that we think is representative, sort of in the same way that we approach people with our cataloging information and say, we think this is right, but we're not entirely sure. So what happens when we're out in these neighborhoods, again, when you think about cultural memory, is people actually start to fill this in for us. They start to be able to fill these holes, because one of the first things that people do when they actually see this media is they start telling us stories about it. It's a natural inclination because it brings up all these associations for them. It reminds them of businesses that aren't there anymore. It reminds them of what the neighborhood looked like when they grew up there. And whether it has anything to do with the media or not, it's so associative that people automatically just want to tell us everything they possibly can about it. And we start to fill in all these amazing gaps. So when you think about how this media could actually be useful in terms of civic technology and building infrastructure, it becomes really interesting very, very, very quickly. If we think about how do we get this data into a mappable flow where you could theoretically show me everything produced within a 4-block radius of my house going back through history, if you could actually hand this over to people who were sitting in these hackathons developing these apps and saying, hey, look, you know, I know that you guys only have 4 hours to sit here today, and you can't go out and do the kinds of legwork that you need to do to really understand this neighborhood. But, you know, at least you can go to this place and get a little bit of an idea of who you're designing for. Because otherwise, you're just designing in a vacuum. You're building on top of what your assumptions are. And that's not ultimately going to be something that's useful to the community or you as a developer or a designer. So a couple weeks ago, Code for America had a hackathon in Chicago, and they actually invited me to do a physical pop-up library at the hackathon so that the developers and the idea people in the room could actually see and get their hands on what the needs and interests of these communities were in that space at that time. And it was amazing. So if we could do that in one small hackathon, imagine what you could do if you brought this to scale. There's a neighborhood in Chicago that I thought I'd talk about just because we're in Austin. Starting on Monday, we're going to be doing a pop-up library in a suburb of Chicago called Oak Park that's directly adjacent to this neighborhood. Now, Oak Park and Austin have a long, long history. Austin was actually annexed by the city of Chicago decades ago. Austin was the epicenter in the late 1960s of the race riots. Austin is a neighborhood that's gone through a huge, tremendous amount of transition, and it's been really wounding to the community, and the community has still never recovered from that. And we look at this neighborhood now that only in the 1960s had a complete demographic shift that went through white flight like nobody's business and has become this area where instead of it once being a big, bright, vital suburb, it's now just become another area just on the west side of Chicago that's suffered a lot of neglect over the years. We did a pop-up library similarly a couple months back in this neighborhood, and actually had a man come up to us in tears because he was just so amazed that somebody had bothered to come and acknowledge the fact that vital culture actually came out of this neighborhood in the first place. So when you think about what this media can actually do, it can do so much on the data side. It can do so much for us as media producers for inspiration. It can do a lot for researchers. But it can do amazing things for community members who've always thought that no one was paying attention to them at all. So our next steps, we've been working on this for a long time. I started this project when I was 23, and it was originally called Chicago Underground Library. And the original idea was just like, let's bring a bunch of artist publications together and put them in a room so people can get to know each other. Well, it's evolved a lot since then. About maybe 2-3 years ago, we thought it would be great if we could build open source software that we could release for different cities to be able to go and change to their needs. We had interest from Seoul, Korea, people who wanted to adapt it to their culture. And so we were going to give them that software, and I get an email every couple of months from Cairo, Egypt, and they want to know what they can do. Now we're thinking about, would it be better as a platform? Maybe it's not best for us to go and release this as discrete software. So this is something that just came up literally a few weeks ago. So I would ask you, besides, if you have any feedback on this, and I think we have time for some questions, which I'm going to go to in a minute. But if you have any feedback or want to get involved on the technology side or just on the thinking side, we really welcome it. We're entirely volunteer-run. We do this with a large core of librarians in Chicago. People leave the Newberry at the end of the day and come catalog with us. Our assistant director, Margaret Heller, is the web services librarian at Dominican University. So we have this huge network of people on the ground in Chicago who are able to think about this data and this community in really amazing ways. So I really welcome not just your input on the project as far as it is in Chicago and as far as it is right now, but to let you know, to kind of go along with the humility stuff, that we're so open to feedback, that we really want to make this work, and we know that we're probably not doing everything right. So keep that in mind, and please contact me. Please reach out, take my card at the end of the session, talk to me. We really want to hear people's opinions on this and also hear questions from you guys.
Of us in here. Nell, that was interesting. It seemed like a lot of the program, rightfully so, is around archival of existing content. What are your thoughts or programs that you're working on to kind of automate the process going forward for, you know, community artifacts that are created from this point forward rather than just stuff that's in the past?
For media that's being produced right now, you mean?
Yeah.
We do take contemporary media as well. So that can be, we get as much, if not more, material donated to us as it comes, as it's produced, than we do from the historical side. So we also want to get that into the flow of information. One thing that we are still working on is trying to figure out, do we try to deal with online information, like blogs and that sort of thing, or do we just let that exist on the internet and try to connect the analog media up to it through information? And that's a point that we're still discussing. Obviously, there's a lot of preservation issues there as well, because not everything that goes online stays online forever, even though people presume that it does.
I actually wanted to ask about the blog issue, just as more and more people are shifting to blogging and to that sort of non-permanent version of cataloging their worlds. And what your opinion is of it, which you sort of covered, but then also more along the lines of like visual records, so photos that aren't necessarily bound and aren't necessarily already curated or collected or printed, but they do have at the same time a space. So a photographer who maybe has a huge collection that does document a community's change, but it's, you know, a photo album or something like that it's kept, or just a file of photos. How would you deal with something like that, or do you?
Well, right now we do go and, you know, it has to be something that was published, that was intended to be put out there, because we do have to go and draw the line somewhere, and there are really great tools that are online already that do that. I'm trying to remember the name of the one for photos. It was like, It Was Here or something. Is that the name of it? And you can go and upload a photo to it and put the geotag on it, and it will put it right on the map of where it was for photos. One thing that's... I forgot to mention before is with the kinds of media that we have, and the way that the internet culture is now, we actually, part of the reason why this is such a perfect and critical time is because the internet culture has helped us think better about amateur and non-professional content, and it has helped change the culture in a lot of ways so that people do appreciate this stuff. So that's one really wonderful cultural shift that we can backpack on, the fact that people do care about blogs and the fact that people do care about community media and citizen journalism. That's huge, because we know that the cultural shift has already taken place on that side of things. Yeah.
There's actually, it's pretty interesting, within the youth culture, the publication I write about, we're doing a lot of stuff about this resurgence of zines within the youth culture, because there's a lot of people, especially within like people like Occupy and activists, groups like that, they consider, you know, they also have blogs and whatnot, but they want something a little more permanent. So there actually is something, kind of a cultural renaissance for this, print publication, and kind of a rethinking of what the idea of zines is, informed by blogs and the last 10 years of online publishing also. So I just wanted to note that.
Yeah, I think the craft movement and the popularization of it through Etsy and a lot of these other forms has made people really think differently about how they treat physical media and whether it's something that they want to get involved in. And we are seeing this huge resurgence of it now. Actually, as I'm speaking, our volunteers are back in Chicago tabling at Chicago Zine Fest this weekend, probably sitting there with their box having people add to it right now.
I was just wondering, I realized I was sort of making up in my own head what I perceive your relationship to the Chicago Public Library and other institutional libraries are, but I'm wondering if you could actually tell me how you're actually getting along with them instead of me presuming how you're actually getting along with them. What kind of relationships do you have with the more institutional libraries, both the publics and the academics or the schools, if you're working with them at all?
It's actually really fascinating. We have had more support come from institutional academic libraries than any other source in the city, any other source of funding, any other source of in-kind donation. So if you go to our website, down at the bottom of it, you'll see that it's hosted through the Great Cities Initiative at the library at the University of Illinois at Chicago. A lot of our shelving actually comes from the Ryerson Library of the Art Institute. A lot of our catalogers come from all these different institutional settings. As far as the public libraries, they're going through a lot of transition right now. They just got a new director. We work with them on a branch level. So we actually are planning a couple pop-up libraries for this year at two different branches in the city of Chicago at this moment. So where we don't have a direct relationship with them, but they definitely see us as a resource that can provide a supplement to their communities, so which is exactly perfectly what we want to do. So with us, we're not saying that, you know, a read-only library doesn't still have a place in our culture. Obviously, there needs to be a place where you can go and see this media and access the information of your day, but we also want to create something where it can be a supplement where people can feel comfortable submitting to it. And at least at the branch level, there are a lot of people recognizing the importance of that.
Does part of this project include digitization of this analog content?
That is a really excellent question. That was the original plan. I started this in 2006 and just sent an email to a few friends and said, meet me in this coffee shop to talk about this. The email got around. We had 40 people we didn't know at our first meeting. And when I went and told this whole group of contemporary publishers and writers that we wanted to go and put all their media online, they freaked out. And so what I slowly came to realize at the time is that there are a lot of people, especially on the content traditional media side, who were still terrified of the internet. And they remain that way today, less of them, fortunately. But one of the things that that made us have to do is to take a step back and seriously consider what our responsibility was in terms of trust to the contemporary community. It suddenly meant that even with the orphan works and the older media that we had, we didn't just want to go and put it online and wait for a takedown notice, because we had to be able to tell the contemporary publishers that we weren't just going to do that to them as soon as they, you know, went on town for a few weeks. So it became this really interesting social negotiation between our interests in putting this media out there and making sure that the contemporary publishers who are going to continue to feed and grow the collection trusted us to respect their copyright. So one thing that I'm working on, it was in an older edition of our website and the form broke, is normally our submission form lets people go and say, you know, I'm sending you my physical media or I'm going to come and bring it by. Here's the way that I would catalog it, just FYI, and it's optional for them to catalog it. But one thing that's not optional is they have to tell us whether or not they own it, whether what they're sending to us is theirs. And if they own it, we invite them to select a Creative Commons license that goes with it, if they want to. That's totally optional. So that once we are able to do digitization, that we have a framework for it, and that we can actually have a built-in way to encourage people to use it digitally. All right. If anybody has any questions, other questions that you want to ask me, please ask me. There's a bunch of thank yous on here. The woman who took most of the amazing photos of the city of Chicago, except for that road cone in a manhole, is Catherine Hodges, and she's phenomenal. Margaret Heller on Twitter is our assistant director, and there's a whole bunch of other phenomenal people who either encouraged me to submit my talk or gave me feedback on it, including one of whom is in the room and whose Twitter handle I got wrong. Sorry, Alexis. But thank you all. Have a great South by.